This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Martin Garbus, who will give us an update on the criminal contempt trial of Stephen Donziger.
Donziger is an environmental lawyer hero. This is the most important climate change case that we've got going on.
Qualified immunity is getting some attention, given the amount of police violence we've seen across the nation.
Ben Cohn, our guest, just wrote the book Above the Law, How Qualified Immunity Protects Violent Police. Let's talk to Ben.
Last week, a bipartisan bill was introduced that could shed a ray of sunshine on the finances for the United States Postal Service.
Trump's cronies have taken control of the post office. They want to destroy it, but we've just had a big victory.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. As we continue our coverage of human rights lawyer Steve Donziger's criminal contempt trial, we look back to the origins of the case he brought against Chevron Oil. It goes back to the late 1960s when Texaco first discovered oil in part of an Amazon rainforest in northeastern Ecuador. The U.S. oil company went on to lord over decades of environmental destruction on a monolithic scale, dumping two or three Exxon Valdez's worth of oil and toxic byproducts and despoiling an area the size of Rhode Island. Since then, the indigenous tribes in the area have been victims of cancer and other illnesses caused by the pollution. In 1993, 2 years after he graduated from Harvard Law School, Stephen Donziger joined a lawsuit seeking to force Texaco to clean up the mess. In 2000, Chevron purchased Texaco. They spent upward of $1 billion in legal fees defending this case. Stephen has broad support from celebrities, including Alec Baldwin and Susan Sarandon, dozens of Nobel laureates, and thousands of attorneys and law students globally. A handful of sympathetic Democratic lawmakers, including U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have written a letter to U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland asking him to investigate the case. And more than 200 attorneys with the International Association of Democratic Lawyers have filed a judicial complaint asking for Judge Kaplan to be removed from the bench. Conversely, Chevron claims that Stephen Donziger's supporters are being duped by what they call a con man. A few conservative outlets have reiterated that narrative. One National Review headline, for example, criticized the so-called lefty media for championing the cause of, quote, history's champion scammer. Joining us with an update on the case, coming straight from the courthouse, is noted attorney Martin Garbus, one of Stephen Donziger's defense team lawyers. Marty, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's a great pleasure to be here again.
Martin, what happened in the first few days of Stephen's criminal contempt trial, and do we have any reason to be hopeful?
There's no reason to be hopeful. For the first time in my life trying a case, I said at the very beginning to the judge that justice has not been done, justice will not be done, and when we make a motion to set aside the convictions, it will be denied. So we have no reason to be hopeful. What we had today was an extraordinary amount of corporate power. For your viewer, or your listener rather, let me just say again, you have a private prosecutor. It's not the U.S. Attorney's Office who is prosecuting. It's from a private law firm that has previously done business with Chevron and wants to do business with Chevron. So they have run up probably about $1 million worth of fees. In addition, they are supported by Chevron, which has really picked up a lot of the work and the preparation. And today we learn that's an amount of roughly $5 million. And also you had FBI people who were being paid allegedly by the government, but it's coming somehow through Chevron. So what you have is a totally private prosecution by a private lawyer supported by private funds by a company which has been litigating against Donziger. They're the defendants in the Ecuadorian lawsuit. So now they have control of the criminal process. I don't know of any case in the United States where this has ever happened before. It's horrendous.
Let's play devil's advocate for a second, Marty. Chevron says that it's got proof that Donziger committed blatant fraud in Ecuador. They claim that Steve blackmailed and bribed a judge, that he secretly controlled a court-appointed expert, and that he even ghostwrote the final judgment. Did the court consider any of this?
That's all nonsense. Let me tell you what happened. The Ecuadorian people tried to file a lawsuit in New York, maybe about 2010. And the Chevron people came in and said, no, there's an Ecuadorian legal system. It should not be here. The Ecuadorian system is fair. So the case on Chevron's motion is kicked out of New York. It goes back to Ecuador, where Chevron has reason to believe it can control the judiciary through money, through power. Lo and behold, the Ecuadorian legal system comes back and gives an extraordinary version because of the destruction and death. And then when they come to New York, Donziger, seeking to enforce the judgment, Kaplan gets the case, and he ultimately invalidates the Ecuadorian judgment on the grounds that you just stated, fraud. And he finds, basically, at the end of the day, Donziger in criminal contempt for doing certain things. Plus, he requires Donziger to pay Chevron's costs in the litigation. Not unusual in a legal system where if a plaintiff loses a case, the defendant can get him to pay costs. The problem in this case, it's become Donziger. And the Ecuadorian people, the damage to the Ecuadorian people, the destruction to the Ecuadorian people, you can barely find that issue of the case. I wanted to open and show a 13-minute video of what Donziger saw when he got there. They would not let me do it. Their position is that Ecuador and the judgment that was obtained there is irrelevant to this proceeding. This proceeding is about Donziger allegedly being in contempt of court because he didn't comply with certain things. So it's really that they have managed in this criminal case, which is all about the Ecuadorians, to take the Ecuadorians out of it. And any time we try and get into what Chevron did, the judge says no.
As we tape this, it's been a few days since the trial started. What was the back and forth? Was there a chance for competing narratives to be raised?
No. When your viewers hear, when your listeners hear this Monday morning, we will be starting the defendant's case, if there is going to be a defendant's case. The prosecution started its case on Monday and it will end, has ended it on Thursday. So your listener will learn during the day whether or not the defendant is going to put in a case. It's not uncomplicated. This judge has made up her mind. Before she even heard the case, she has Donziger under house arrest for some nearly 2 years. Never before, nothing like this ever happened before in the American legal system. He's being charged with a petty offense, which also means he can't have a jury. So he didn't have a jury in the Ecuadorian case for Kaplan. No American jury to decide. In this case, there'll be no jury to decide. But there were some people from the press, and they sat in the jury room. And at the close of my opening argument, I said, the jury will be the larger world. The jury will hear about it, men, women, and children throughout the world that will see what Chevron has done here. And they basically try to stop that from happening. And I would say they more or less succeeded. The judge who has been appointed in this case, Judge Loretta Preska, is a member of the Federalist Society, honored by the Federalist Society. Chevron is a substantial donor to the Federalist Society. What happened in this case is Kaplan decided to prosecute. He went to the U.S. attorney, Berman, and he said, prosecute, as he has a right to do, prosecute. The U.S. attorney said no. And the government's view is, well, he said no because he didn't have any money to do it. It was an expensive prosecution. The U.S. attorney had 262 lawyers. He has a budget of over $50 million. We are trying to get Berman on the stand. Today, we sent out requests to the government to have Berman come in and testify, and to learn more, it will be denied. Any attempt that we make to find out what really happened in this case, how does it go from a U.S. attorney saying no? We've also learned that since 2010, Chevron has been trying to get a prosecution of this case in varying stages. And each U.S. attorney along the way has said no. But there is a statute, Rule 42, which says that if the U.S. attorney says no, then a judge can appoint a private prosecutor to do it. This is the first case of its kind that tests that. So we're walking into uncharted legal waters where one presumes every protection will be given to companies like Chevron, so that when there are these suits throughout the country for the destruction of the environment, destruction of cultures, the Chevrons and the Exxons of the world will be protected. So it's a massive case in the sense of the issues arising. And normally, and they would have expected, since it's only 6 months or whatever, that we wouldn't go through with the defense to show exactly what's happening, because we also know the defense will not work under this legal system. So that's where we are. I have an enormous sense of frustration. We've done everything we can, and there's not going to be a good outcome.
Martin Garbus, criminal contempt charges are very rare. What they're doing to Donziger is really almost unprecedented. They're intended to punish a defendant rather than to force compliance with a court order, the way civil contempt charges are. Judge Kaplan, who incidentally was the former attorney for Big Tobacco, Judge Kaplan drew up the criminal contempt charges himself in July of 2019 after Steve refused to comply with an order directing him to turn over his electronic devices, his cell phone, his computer. Tell our listeners if this is standard practice.
I've never heard it happen before. But also what the statute says is that if the U.S. attorney says no, then the judge, Kaplan in this case, can go into the wheel, and the wheel will give you a judge. He didn't do that. He went straight to someone he's known for 20 years, someone whose politics is the same thing as his. He would have every reason to believe that this judge is going to give him the result that he wants, and he's right. I hate to be so gloomy. I guess you come out of a day in court, and the whole thing is so rigged. I've seen a lot. I've never seen such an enormous amount of private money being paid for prosecution to benefit a private client. There's a Supreme Court case called Young, which says you shouldn't do this, that a prosecutor can't have two masters. What we've also learned in the case is that the U.S. attorney has no supervision over the private prosecutor in this case. So the private prosecutor, being paid for by government funds with a contribution of $5 million from Chevron, under the law as they construe it, is responsible to no one. If it's a U.S. attorney, he has a board. If it's a U.S. attorney, there are certain precepts. But here, the private prosecutor has a goal to make a great deal of money, and two, to use the case as an extraordinary marketing tool, because they will be the first people to really utilize all these various options in the law. So the Seward and Kissel law firm, which is doing it, will now become extraordinarily wealthy because they will draw the business of the Exxons, the Chevron, everybody who's involved in the economic destruction area. So the case is not only horrific in its own terms, but it's horrific in what it's a start of. Now, we have contacted Merrick Garland, and we are asking him to intervene. He has a busy plate. and he's certainly not going to intervene before there's a verdict. So ultimately, maybe there is, and I'm not optimistic about it, a political resolution where Merrick Garland says, no, we're not going to permit this. Now, of course, this prosecution was started under Trump, and the U.S. attorney who refused to prosecute this case was fired by Trump and Bill Barr. Now, he may have had other transgressions. For example, he wanted to prosecute Giuliani, and he wanted to prosecute some of Trump's friends as well. So Berman was fired. He was fired because of his politics or his sense of where the law should be. This is the man who refused to prosecute Danziger. So that's the man we're trying to get the Corman to court to testify. I think it's highly unlikely we'll be successful.
Oh, Martin, can you explain for our listeners what happens either way after the verdict?
After the verdict, Danziger was ordered to comply with certain discovery orders. One of the orders dealt with his monetization or attempting to raise money further to prosecute the case. Kaplan said, you cannot do it. In a decision that came down 6 weeks ago, the Second Circuit said that Kaplan's order was ambiguous. It was difficult to understand. And it indicated that it should be set aside. Nonetheless, the judge is saying here, Preska, that I can find a saving hook. In other words, whatever the Second Circuit has said about the vagueness and unenforceability of this injunction, she is saying, I'm now going to be able to find a way to do it. So it's an extraordinary case in that the Second Circuit has ruled on a portion of the case. I don't want to overstate it. On a portion of the case. And she refuses to follow that. She says, this is my interpretation of what the Second Circuit said. And if I'm wrong, she said, you'll deal with it on the appeal from the conviction. I'm sorry if this is sound convoluted. It is convoluted.
What happens in terms of Stephen's liberty?
He has been under house arrest now for close to 2 years. If he is convicted, there are X number of counts. It could be 6 months on each count. It could be 6 months altogether. And what he's charged with is really no more serious. It's a misdemeanor. Driving drunk is a misdemeanor. I mean, there are endless misdemeanors that nobody gets prosecuted for and nobody gets sentenced to. He's already done 2 years. Now, it's not 2 years in the MCC. But he's got a wife and a child, confined to his house, can't earn any income at all, and he's facing, perhaps, I think, and I don't want to be too negative, he's facing the certainty of further imprisonment for a misdemeanor. One of the reasons they charge it as a misdemeanor, they could have charged it, putting all other things aside, as a felony or this or that, because there's other ways of doing it. A misdemeanor deprives you of a jury trial. So we made a motion for a jury trial, and she denied it. And my judgment is we're going to take that up to the Court of Appeals and lose it. Yeah. It is inconceivable that Chevron could also have influenced the Bar Association, which has disbarred Steve. I was there at the hearings. And at the hearings, Chevron would have every day at the hearings five people, partners, $1,000 an hour, $50,000 a day, and we were told they had nothing at all to do with the Bar Association. Today we learned, 2 or 3 years later, that they were speaking to the Bar Association throughout, that they were preparing the Bar Association. So I don't know of any case offhand where you have seen the extent of corporate power involved in a litigant with a private citizen, Danziger, where they can influence a bar association, where they can influence a legal system, and they can have their own person be the prosecutor. I keep referring to the prosecution team as the Chevron prosecution team. They originally objected, but I've been doing it relentlessly. And now throughout the transcript, it's described not as the U.S. attorney, not as the American government, not as Seward and Kissel, But as the Chevron prosecution team, which it is, there is no case that I know of where this much corporate power was spent attacking one guy. And of course, they're not attacking one guy. They're making it clear to anybody who goes after environmental destruction in the way that Donziger did that everything horrible is going to happen to him. So the case is both horrific in its own terms, but horrific for the future.
Marty Garbus, how can our listeners support Steve Donziger?
Steve Donziger at this point is a man who has had his license lifted. He has a wife and a child. He desperately needs money to keep going. This has been for him. This struggle is going on for 28 years. It started out when he's a very young man, close to 30 years ago. He's a little older now. He's 55. But he's given up his life. So there's a Donziger campaign to raise money. We had hoped at some point that it would raise money for lawyers, but it never will. And I'm pro bono. Ron Kuby, a very good lawyer, is also pro bono. That's one way. We've also had a number of rallies. There was a rally downtown with Susan Sarandon, Roger Waters, I think Alec Baldwin was there, a woman named Marianne Williamson, who ran for president, who I don't know, but I heard about her. And we had a rally. In total, there are 500,000 Ecuadorians in New York. So we had a very substantial rally and a determination somehow to affect Chevron. We have some Chevron stockholders who will go into board meetings and stockholders meetings and try and make trouble. The problem is keeping the issue visible. The Donziger prosecution, in a very peculiar way, hides it. Because all it is Chevron against Donziger, and you forget what the whole thing is about. So the question is, how do you keep alive the fact that so many people were killed, that an entire country was despoiled, so that, you know, you have second and third generation people now with cancer, and you go down there, the water's a mess, it's all sludge. So the question is, how do you keep that issue alive? And that requires a great deal of organizing. You know, I come out of the days of Cesar Chavez, and we used to organize. It's one thing to organize in Bakersfield about a particular issue there. It's another thing to organize against Exxon, Chevron, and the fossil fuel or pipelines. It's very difficult. It requires an extraordinary amount of consciousness and an extraordinary amount of commitment. This isn't just going to a one-day rally. This requires commitment for years. And the people who have supported Donziger all this time have had that kind of commitment. But it's not enough.
Marty Garbus, unfortunately, we've come to an end of our allotted time. We want to let you go. Save up some strength. You're in the middle of a huge battle. It's going to go on for another week or so. And we'll check in with you again and learn what's been happening. Keep up the good fight, Marty. And thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Bye.
Judicially created doctrine of qualified immunity has been so broadly interpreted that it acts as a shield for policemen in all but the rarest of circumstances. Only when the exact same abusive behavior of a cop has already been deemed unconstitutional by a court in the exact same jurisdiction can a victim succeed in a civil lawsuit. That's a lawsuit for money, not a criminal lawsuit, a civil lawsuit against an abusive police officer. A plaintiff must show that government officials violated clearly established law to receive damages for harm. The plaintiff wins only if a prior court found an official liable under a nearly identical fact pattern. This standard is virtually impossible to meet, and the protections promised under the Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act are therefore largely symbolic. We speak today with Ben Cohn, who's the co-founder and former CEO of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. He's the founder of a variety of advocate organizations and the author of several books, including the latest, titled Above the Law, How Qualified Immunity Protects Violent Police. It's published by OR Books. Ben and his partner Jerry Greenfield are currently helping to lead the campaign to end qualified immunity.
Ben Cohen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much. It's, shall I say, bad to be here.
Ben, tell us what qualified immunity is and what's the rationale behind it?
Well, qualified immunity essentially means that if a cop breaks the law and you try to sue him, the cop is going to get off. The case will be thrown out of court. You know, the basic premise behind qualified immunity is that the legal system doesn't expect cops to know the law. It doesn't expect law enforcement officers to know the law unless there's been another cop previously convicted of breaking that very same law in exactly the same circumstances, and apparently exactly the same circumstances never happens.
So there's a catch-22 there, isn't it?
Yes, it is a catch-22. And, I mean, the other catch-22 part is that since you can't show that something has been against the law before, you can't have anything that's new against the law. So the law is frozen in legal terminology.
Where did qualified immunity come from?
It's a pretty interesting story. You know, after the Civil War, there was a problem in that many police officers were still members of the Ku Klux Klan. And so they would be abusing and discriminating against black people. And so Congress passed a law that said if a law enforcement officer violates your constitutional rights, you can sue him in court. And that really solved the problem for about 100 years. And then starting around the 1960s, the Supreme Court issued some interpretations of that law, which essentially said that, well, we can't really expect police, law enforcement officers, to know the law unless there has been another cop who violated the law previously in exactly that same jurisdiction, in exactly the same way, and if those conditions are met, you can sue the law officer. But the problem is that there's never any two situations that are the same, and in the huge majority of cases, when people try to sue bad cops for abusing them, the case gets thrown out of court based on qualified immunity.
Ben, can you give us an example or two from your book on how this has happened, how qualified immunity has protected police?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was a case that was down in Texas of, you know, these two off-duty police officers who heard a call on their radio about two black guys who had stolen some sneakers. They heard the call, they looked in front of them, they saw a black guy. He was walking, he just got off work, he was walking towards his friend's house. And they yelled out to him, "Hey, what are you doing? Where are you going?" And the guy lifts up his hand to point to the apartment he's going to, and they shoot him, paralyzing him from the chest down for the rest of his life. They shot him within 6 seconds of approaching him, and shot him in the back. Then they proceeded to falsify their report to say that this guy had assaulted them. So he ends up going to the hospital, handcuffed to his bed. You know, this guy was totally innocent. The only thing that was the same as the description is the color of his skin. The cops got off on qualified immunity.
Yeah, that's really horrific. Give us another example, please. We want our listeners to get an idea of how this law is so ruinous.
Well, there was another situation where a suspect had surrendered by kneeling on the ground with his hands in the air, And then a police officer sicked his attack dog on him, sending him to the hospital. You know, some lawyers with Injustice Watch found out about this and said, well, we've got a really good case here, because previously in this same jurisdiction, there was a case where a police officer sicked their dog on a suspect that had surrendered, and that police officer was found guilty. So they took it to court, and the judge ended up throwing the case out, saying that the situations were not similar enough to overcome qualified immunity. That in the first situation, where the officer was convicted, the cop, the suspect was lying down and surrendering by lying down. And in this situation, the suspect was kneeling with his hands up, and therefore the cases are not similar, and he got the case was thrown out. The officers got off on qualified immunity.
Yeah, that's really horrific. It's a distinction without a difference. Ben Cohn, you've recently had published the excellent little book called Above the Law, How Qualified Immunity Protects Violent Police. Or Books put it out. And, you know, we've known about you for years because of Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream. How did you get involved, and why did you get involved in opposing this horrific law?
Well, you know, I think like millions and millions of Americans, I've been outraged the continual abuse by bad cops of black people, going so far as to murder them. And then what drives me crazy is that the cops get off. Either they're not prosecuted, or if they are prosecuted, you know, like 2 years later, you hear that they got off with a slap on the wrist. You know, again, like millions of Americans, this all came to a head with the George Floyd murder. You know, I felt like I need to do something about it. And I started to do a little research on it and learned about qualified immunity and learned that we can hold cops accountable by overturning this controversial judicial doctrine. It's not even a law.
Ben, tell us about the organization that you're heading up now, the Campaign to End Qualified Immunity, and what kind of support are you getting?
We're getting a tremendous amount of support. We now have a coalition of over 16 national organizations, going all the way from American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP to Cato and Americans for Prosperity. We have a bunch of retired law officers. We've got thousands of professional sports players, artists, musicians. You know, a very robust organization. We are fighting to overturn qualified immunity, both on the state level and at on the federal level. And right now, it's this very issue of qualified immunity that is part of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act that the Senate wants to get rid of. And so that now is exactly the right time for people to contact their senators and let them know that they want to end qualified immunity.
Ben, what forces currently support qualified immunity, and who are you up against?
The main obstruction, the main opponent to ending qualified immunity are the police unions, particularly the Fraternal Order of Police. You know, on some level, you can kind of understand it. I mean, if you're already immune from prosecution, do you want to change the law so that you can be prosecuted? You know, I mean, the reality is that the only people who ending qualified immunity affects are bad cops, cops who break the law. The other reality is that good cops are benefited by ending qualified immunity, because once you end it, then you have true accountability for the police. And, you know, the police need the community to trust them. They just don't understand that it's a two-way street, that if you're not willing to be held accountable, then the community isn't going to trust you.
Ben, we're running down to the end of our allotted time here, but I wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite passage from your book, Above the Law, that you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, mostly that the absurd assumption of qualified immunity is that police officers, otherwise known as law enforcement officers, are not expected to know the law. I mean, for regular everyday people, you and me, ignorance of the law is no excuse. We all know that. But if you're a cop, ignorance of the law is an excuse. And that's an abomination. You know, if I were to haul off and punch you in the face, you could sue me. If I were a cop and I did that, the case would get thrown out of court.
Ben, I'm sure that many of our listeners are excited to hear about your campaign. How can they get involved in supporting the work to abolish qualified immunity?
Yeah, go to the website, the campaign website, holdcopsaccountable.org. That's holdcopsaccountable.org. And enter your name in the spot where it says email, and then we'll notify you when your voice counts the most. And we make it really easy to call your legislator, write a letter to the editor, do whatever is the most important thing at that time.
We've been speaking with Ben Cohn, whose excellent little book, Above the Law, How Qualified Immunity Protects Violent Police, has just come out. It's published by Orr Books. It's got a foreword by Michael Render, who some of our listeners may know as Killer Mike. Ben, you've done a tremendous job on this so far, and we wish you every success, and we'll get back to you when we find out how it comes out. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
All right. Great being on the show with you. Thanks for your help.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Postal Service advertises its official standard of delivering first-class mail, a typical letter with a 55-cent stamp, within 1 to 3 business days. The news department at WGBH Radio in Boston conducted its own test to see if this still holds true. News reporters and producers sent nearly 100 letters from different places in that metro area at various hours on the same day to their pick of correspondents in 38 states, creating a random sample. The letters were addressed to residents of large cities, suburbs, and small towns. The USPS flunked the test. A little more than half of the letters arrived within the 3-day window. Slower delivery is just the tip of the post office's problems, and things are going from bad to worse. The Postal Service issued a report recently called Delivering for America, calling for a reorganization that highlights shared sacrifice. Many consider it an austerity plan to cover for de facto privatization. Critics say the plan will slow the mail, raise prices, and cut services. And since the report was published, the Postal Service announced the closing of 18 mail processing plants. That will take place before November. Based on recent history, closing these plants will further slow the mail and guarantee problems with delivery during peak seasons. Joining us again to talk about what this means for the future of the United States Postal Service is Chuck Zlatkin. Chuck is the legislative director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union. Chuck, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me.
Chuck, just as we're recording this segment, bipartisan legislation was introduced that has the potential to change the Postal Service's financial crisis. Give us a brief overview of that, please.
Okay, well, it's important to note that the powers that wanted to eventually privatize the post office put through the legislation that would require the Postal Service to pre-fund future retirees' health benefits, and that's really been a burden on the Postal Service the past number of years. And this legislation, if it goes through, would eliminate that, would eliminate the past debt and more, make it more possible for the Postal Service to function. So in that case, it's a major victory.
It's been a while since we've spoken with you, and I'd like to refamiliarize our listeners with some of the key players. Let's start with Ron Blum. Who is he, what does he do, and why should we care?
Okay, well, Ron Blum, to some people it matters that he's a Democrat. He was actually nominated to the Postal Board of Governors by then-President Donald Trump to fill out an existing term back in August of 2019. Actually, that term ended on December 8th of 2020. He's currently in what's called a holdover year, but as the holdover, which means that he could be replaced. President Biden could just say, I want to put someone else on there, and then Blum is gone. But Blum, in February, was voted in as the chair of the Postal Board of Governors by the Republican majority, the six existing board members, four Republicans, two Democrats, all appointed by Trump. Voted Blum as their chair. The reason what becomes interesting is that Blum, very big supporter of Postmaster DeJoy and all his plans supposedly to save the Postal Service, which is really putting it in jeopardy. Also, Blum, it's interesting because when DeJoy was voted in as Postmaster General, they actually skirted the plan. They actually had a search agency go out there and get the top qualified people around the country for the vacancy, and they recommended 200 people, and then that was reduced to then 53 and then to 13. DeJoy wasn't any of these people. He was forced in by the then Trump administration to be considered, and then he was actually chosen. At the time, there were only four members of the Postal Board of Governors, three Republicans and one Democrat, Blum. They voted unanimously for DeJoy, and since that time, Blum has been DeJoy's number one supporter.
Who has called for DeJoy's resignation, and on what grounds?
Well, there's been quite a response to what's happened with the mail, the delays in the mail. So a number of people in the House, Bill Pascal from New Jersey and Tim Ryan from Ohio, were leading the charge. They were so strong, they said that DeJoy needed to be fired, and if the Postal Board of Governors didn't remove him, they should be fired. In the Senate, Tammy Duckworth, she was very strong. She actually wrote a letter to the Postal Board of Governors, in a sense, demanding that they fire DeJoy, but a letter was written back to her by our friend Ron Blum, saying that the Postal Board of Governors is unanimous in supporting DeJoy as postmaster. And many editorials, people coming out, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Government, they call for DeJoy to be fired, and there's Common Cause and 16 other organizations have an online petition, an action network, calling for DeJoy to be fired. Actually, people could go look for that and sign on to that. So there's across the board, from people in government, from people in agencies, from people who were concerned about the mail being done the way it's supposed to be, have all called for DeJoy to be fired.
Chuck, I understand that both Bloom and DeJoy have proposed closing several plants. Tell us what the impact of plant closings to their communities would be.
Okay, yes, so it called for the closing of 18 mail processing plants, which are located around the country. And this is where mail is processed, prepared to be sent to local post offices to be delivered. And these are big operations that employ many people in the community. And by closing these plants in the particular community, where in some cases these processing plants operate 24 hours a day, would be a blow to the people who work there, because they would have to find new jobs, but also to local businesses in the community that service the plants and the people who work there. In any time that this takes place, it's a real economic blow to the community, and besides setting in motion delaying the mail even further. And these plants, in their plan, they want all of these 18 plants to be closed by November, which means that these plants will be closed again in time for the peak season around holiday time, which again would just damage the postal service.
Chuck, first class mail used to be delivered in a day or 2 days, at the utmost 3 days, and now it's taken 3 to 5 days. What's the story behind that?
That came in when DeJoy was named Postmaster General. He took over in June 15. By July, there was already major delays in the mail because he was eliminating the use of overtime. He was saying that trucks should be sent out even if they didn't have mail in them. I mean, it was really insane. So people really felt this delay in first-class mail. And so what DeJoy wants to do in the 10-year plan and his other actions he's taken is to basically say that should be what would be acceptable to people, receiving first-class mail up to 5 days as opposed to, you know, 1 or 2 days. Now, this impacts not only upon people getting their mail, but also people in terms of paying their bills and the whole system that's set up that when people have to get, you know, the bill paying back in or receiving checks, important papers. It really is a disaster. And what he's saying, that DeJoy is saying, well, yeah, if we do it in 5 days, then we'll be 95% on time, as opposed to being on time as mandated by what it's supposed to be. You're getting people, you know, 1 or 2 or maybe 3 days. And the fact that this guy is still in his office is really disturbing.
Chuck, many of the criticisms over DeJoy are that, as a business person, and with the changes he's already enacted, we're veering toward privatization of the Postal Service. Do you think the recent legislation that's introduced has lessened the odds that might happen? And what would privatization look like?
Well, it would take off the initial financial burden that the Postal Service is facing, but if these changes to delay the mail even further instituted, it's going to drive business away. There will be those who can do business elsewhere will do it. So the idea of privatization, and we've seen it taking place, you know, in other places around the world, privatization means the service is worse and it costs more. And in terms of privatization, right now there's a universal service. In other words, wherever you live in this country, you get mail service to your home, business, you know, 6 days a week. And with privatization, that just won't happen. Privatization, they only want to deliver mail to where it's profitable, not where, you know, it's costly. So privatization would really change the nature of the Postal Service, and it will never be the same. I mean, people who depend upon the Postal Service will really be hurt by it, and those who can't afford alternatives will really be destroyed. So it privatization. They want de facto privatization, which will mean they'll eliminate as many jobs as they can that are being done currently by unionized workers and replace them at will worker at minimum wage. That's really a terrible aspect to what's happening. So it'll be bad service, costing more, and eliminate good living wage jobs from communities.
Chuck Zlatkin, what I don't get is the Democrats control the House. They've got power in the Senate. Why can't they get rid of DeJoy and Bloom? What's the problem here?
Okay, well, first of all, the Postmaster General is appointed by and serves at the pleasure of the Postal Board of Governors. And right now, the Postal Board of Governors has six members, all of them appointed by Trump. There are three who Biden has nominated. But as long as you have Bloom on the Postal Board of Governors as chair and the other supposed Democrats, Donald Moak, who basically have been supporters of DeJoy, they're not going to remove DeJoy. I mean, that's the, now, again, Bloom could be removed by President Biden by just saying, I want to replace you with another person. There's no big process there because he's already passed his time. But that hasn't happened yet, and it needs to. And so people need to respond and contact in terms of getting DeJoy out and also denying a Bloom for more time, because there are people who are pushing Bloom to get another 7-year term on the Postal Board of Governors, and that would be a disaster. So again, it's, you know, people would think, well, you know, Biden's in there, so DeJoy is gone, but it doesn't work that way. It's the Postal Board of Governors who determines who the postmaster is.
Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our allotted time, but we know that listeners are very concerned about this issue. How can they learn more and get involved?
Well, the main thing is to contact your federal elected officials, both your the House of Representatives or in the Senate, because they're the ones who really are the ones who can influence and determine what's going to take place with the future of the Postal Service. Their constituents in every area. This isn't a red or blue issue. People need the Postal Service as much in rural areas as they do in urban areas or the suburbs. So contact your elected officials and demand that there be a positive actions to making sure that the Postal Service remains public. It's their Postal Service. It needs to be public. And just say that they want DeJoy out as Postmaster General. The senators and House cannot do it directly, but they can call these people in before their committees and out them. And the best way to go online and to see some of these on YouTube and see some of the hearings that have taken place, where the arrogance of DeJoy and the Bloom, you see who these people are, and you realize that they're not committed to the public Postal Service and they're not committed to you. So really put the pressure on your local officials to get these guys out of it.
Chuck Zlatkin, it's always a pleasure to get updates from you. We'll stay in touch, and thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure, and it's a great opportunity to be able to speak to your audience about something as important as Postal Service.
Thanks so much, Chuck. You take it easy.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.